Lack of knowledge about the rest of the universe has led us to make some assumptions about visitors who might come from other worlds to Earth. They range from the friendly but hairstyle-challenged Vulcans of Star Trek to interstellar monsters who just want us for food. That's the popular culture range. There is real science to be applied here, and our guest this hour does just that, extrapolating the forces that shaped Earth creatures to planets and other systems. Eric Kirschenbaum is the author of The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. Eric Kirschenbaum is a zoologist, astrobiologist, teacher, and fellow of Girton College at the University of Cambridge in the UK. His research focuses on wolves and other canids, along with dolphins and other cetaceans, and occasionally, as you can tell, his attention wanders off planet. Eric Kirschenbaum, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. Thanks for inviting me.
So when did we start calling exobiology astrobiology?
Well, astrobiology is a term that's been around. It's been around for a while. It's just had a very low profile because there's not really been much to do with it until recently. And I think recently there's been such an upsurge in interest because we're starting to understand now that there are a lot of planets out there, and there are a lot of planets that are much more like Earth than we expected. And so we've got to start thinking about what the nature of life might be on these planets.
I still remember asking Mrs. Bude in the elementary school library about books about other solar systems because, you know, I was reading Superman by then. And she said, "Do we know there are other solar systems?" Now, boy, oh boy, do we know.
We really do. And it's interesting that as we find out a little bit more and a little bit more, we can see that our technology, the way that our technology, our ability to detect these planets and to find out about them, find out what they're like, is increasing so fast that we just, you know, we just don't know where to turn. Almost every month we find out that there are more of these planets and more Earth-like, more diverse than we ever thought possible.
Now, there's been some ebb and flow in thinking about life elsewhere. Are we on a bit of an upswing at the moment, thinking that there's almost certainly life somewhere?
We really are. I mean, in the past, it's been mostly sort of philosophical discussions. There wasn't much data. There wasn't much evidence. So people had to try and reason whether they thought life existed elsewhere or not. And you're certainly right that it wasn't that many years ago that people felt that Earth was somewhere really special, really possibly even unique in all the combination of the factors that made life possible here on Earth. I think that's gone now. We understand now that there are just so many planets and so diverse that there are likely to be a lot of them that are just as capable of holding life as Earth.
But I have often wondered if we define life too narrowly. I mean, is it possible we could be missing signs of it?
I think it's a difficult question, because when you do start doing research and looking at the atmospheres of planets and other solar systems, you need to know what you're looking for. You need to design your instruments to detect things that you think are lifelike. But it's not quite as difficult as you suggest, because we know some features of life that are really essential. We know that life has to be, firstly, it has to be out of equilibrium with the environment, right? If you're just like a rock that's next to you, you're not alive. Life is something that remains different from everything around it. And that's okay. That's a good thing, because it's easy to detect. You can detect chemical imbalances in an atmosphere that shouldn't be there, which is a really good sign of life, whatever the life is like.
Now, as the book begins to unfold the story here, the laws of physics and chemistry, as you point out, are consistent. So would those dictate biology at least somewhat consonant with what we have on Earth?
There are some parts of it that do. That's certainly true. Like I said, we know that life needs to be different from the environment, and that takes energy. It doesn't matter what you're made of, what chemicals you're made of. Are you carbon-based or silicon-based or something else? You need energy. You need energy to keep yourself alive. And these laws of physics and chemistry, how can you use energy? How can you store energy? How can you move it around your body if you have a body of sorts, which we think you probably will? So there are some constraints from physics and chemistry about just what life must be like fundamentally. And then there are other constraints on how the physics of the universe dictate what animals will be like, what they can do and what they can't do.
Well, and at this point in the book, you write that the short-sightedness of natural selection actually makes our predictions about alien life much easier. How is that?
That's right, because we tend to think when we're imagining about aliens, if you imagine what an alien might be like, you might impose on it all kinds of things that you might want, you know, to be able to fly or to be able to move things with your mind and all these ideas about what would be really good to have if you had the ability to have whatever you wanted. But that's not how natural selection works. Natural selection doesn't look ahead to what things would be good and what would be advantageous. It's just one step at a time. It's just, does this give me an immediate advantage today? And because natural selection works like that in that kind of blind fashion, then we don't need to think about what kind of fantastic features these creatures might have. They'll have whatever they need to solve the immediate problems that are facing them today.
This is almost like as if we discovered another continent, as you point out in the book. I mean, would some knowledge of Australia, for example, with today's science, have led biologists to assume things like hopping marsupials?
Well, the thing about life on Earth is that it does all come from one origin. So all life on Earth is related. Every two individuals of any two different species, they're all related if you go back far enough. So there are some constraints on life on Earth that we can use to our advantage to predict what life might be like in Australia. When people arrived in Australia, no matter how unusual kangaroos looked, they still looked like mammals in many ways, and they had fur and they had bones like we have. So much of what we see on Earth, we can predict because all life on Earth is related, all mammals on Earth share certain features. That doesn't quite work when it comes to life on other planets. But there are still some principles that we can use and that we can use to infer what this life's going to be like.
Eric, what kinds of assumptions do you make about beings that would be intelligent enough to be able to visit us?
Well, getting the technology to be able to come and visit Earth, that's a technology well beyond anything that we can imagine. So clearly these would be very, very intelligent creatures. But where does intelligence come from? You know, all animals are intelligent to some extent. This idea of technology that can build things, can build spaceships, build airplanes, build the things that we do, is really unique. We're the only species on Earth that's done this. And we think we have a pretty good idea of why that is. It's probably because our ancestors lived in really, really complex societies. So there were really complex inter-individual interactions. They needed to remember who their friends were, who their enemies were, who of their friends were enemies with their friends' enemies, and all these kinds of complex social relationships. And that probably drove the evolution of the complex brains that we have that allowed us to reach this level of technology. And it seems very likely that a similar process would be necessary for that kind of technological intelligence to develop on another planet, some kind of complex social environment which would make these animals or these alien organisms very, very social in a very complex way.
Oh, so this is what leads you to say that it's easier to predict how aliens might act or their behavior rather than what they look like.
Yeah, the laws of evolution as we understand them, the rules by which the traits that an organism evolves are constrained, are quite well understood. They're quite mathematical, but they relate to behavior rather than the form that animals have. There are actually many different ways that you can crawl or fly or swim. There are not that many different ways that you can behave, because behavior is all about interactions between individuals, how you cooperate, how you compete, and there's a fairly firm theoretical understanding of when cooperation happens and when competition happens.
Which is, this is, you know, for all the ways in which we become disconnected from each other and resentful of each other, this is a good thing to remember that humans got to where we are because we lifted each other up.
We did. Our ancestors were extremely social. You know, there are a lot of animals in the world that don't live in large groups. There are a lot of animals that live in large groups, like wildebeest, But they don't really have very complex interactions. They just all sort of hang around and eat the grass and so on. Whereas our ancestors did more than that. They cooperated. They helped each other to find food. They helped each other to defend themselves against predators and so on. So our very existence is very much dependent on that highly, highly interactive social structure.
Let's talk about natural selection a bit. You give a brief lesson on it in the book and remind us it's the accumulation of benefits that keep a creature going versus other creatures, perhaps. But then you get to things like zebra stripes, which has anybody figured out what the benefit might be to the zebra?
Well, there are a lot of ideas, and it's very hard sometimes to look at a particular trait like stripes or like a kangaroo's feet or the horns of an antelope and say, well, these are for something. Because animals are complex. Animals have a lot of complex traits to them, and usually natural selection is acting on many, many different things at the same time. So it's very rare that some feature of an animal evolves for one specific purpose. Usually it's a combination of effects of many, many different things. So you might grow long antlers because it makes you attractive to the opposite sex, but of course then they're heavy and you know, they might weigh you down, they might stop you from getting away from a predator. So there are always a lot of different effects that are going on. And it's rarely just one thing that causes a trait to evolve.
You mentioned the name of a scientist, George Price, who helped the science but apparently hurt himself in the process. What was his equation and what happened to him?
So although Darwin obviously understood the concept of natural selection, it took quite a long time before biologists could really tie this down and write in mathematical form what it is that's going on when traits evolve and when animals evolve. And it was the process of a number of scientists in the middle of the last century who realized that it's all about how much benefit you gain from a particular action, and in particular, how much the benefit that you gain is related to the things about you, the traits you have. Do you have long horns, or do you have long fur, or do you help other people? And so there was between Price and some other scientists at the time, they built up a model of when it's beneficial to help and when it's beneficial to compete and not to help. And unfortunately for George Price anyway, although it's clearly a complex story and he had a complex life, but he found these ideas very, very disheartening, because everything could, the idea of whether you should help someone or not help them could apparently be reduced to mathematical formulae. And that's, you know, that's something that philosophers struggle with today as well.
The sense that we things happen for no apparent reason, or that they're strictly tied to mathematical laws, and it sort of indicates that there's not a lot of human input there or something.
Well, when you look at the animal world, apart from humans, it does seem to be that a lot of behavior can be very well predicted on a large scale, you know, on an individual scale, but on a large scale, it can be well predicted by some mathematical rules of evolution, because these animals are acting in a way that they've evolved to act this way because it's generally beneficial to them. And so that seems in some ways rather predictable if you look at meerkats, when meerkats will provide food to other meerkats that are perhaps not their children. You know, we can make clear predictions about why they would do that and when. The situation is very different with humans. Humans have, of course, evolved this intellect that we have, and our social skills and our social abilities have kind of put us beyond that. So we make decisions about when to be nice to others or when not to be nice to others, not so much based on evolutionary considerations, but more based on our cultural heritage and the ideas and experiences that we've gone through. So in some ways, we're very different from a lot of other animals. And so we shouldn't really be too upset and too concerned about being bound to evolutionary mathematical constraints. We're really not. We've got a lot more flexibility than that.
But the rest of the animal world, then, I mean, as you point out, natural selection produces similar forms. You know, flying mammals, bats, and flying birds. Different functions, or they're different species that have similar functions, therefore similar form. So should we assume similarly constructed creatures on other planets?
Well, some of those forms are very tightly constrained by physics. You took the example of flight. There are not actually that many ways you can fly. Okay, you can fly like a hot air balloon, or you can fly using wings. There are actually physically not that many different ways that you can fly. And on Earth, we see animals fly with wings. Animals fly by floating, mostly in the water. It's still flying because the water is a fluid just like the air. But animals on Earth seem to have used all of the different physical ways of flying that there are. And animals on another planet don't have access to a different physics. They don't have any alternative ways of flying that animals here don't have. So it makes a lot of sense that animals on an alien world, if they fly, will fly in similar ways to animals on this planet. Those are just the constraints of physics.
Eric Kirschenbaum is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. And we're learning about laws of physics, chemistry, evolution, apparently consistent from place to place, which would give us some indications about what life from other places might look like. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Excellent point made in the book about mass extinctions upon the Earth and what followed them. What do they teach us about what you're talking about here?
Well, the Earth has been through a number of really quite extreme mass extinctions in the past, where many species, perhaps even in some cases up to 95% of the species on the planet went extinct. So these were clearly very, very risky times for life. Life could have been wiped out on Earth completely, but it wasn't. And then what happened is we had a world where most of the species had been wiped out, but those that remained had many opportunities with very little competition. And so we got an explosion of diversity in the millions of years that followed these mass extinctions. And it's generally thought that a sequence of mass extinctions like this are necessary to provide a planet with the kind of diversity that we see today. Without those mass extinctions, yes, evolution would take place, but it would be rather slow. The most famous example is the asteroid that sent the dinosaurs extinct and allowed the mammals in particular to take up a lot of the niches that were previously occupied by dinosaurs. So we kind of think that this kind of periodic disastrous event is one of the things that led to the diversity that we see on Earth today, and would probably be necessary for another planet to have a similar kind of diversity to Earth.
It sounds almost like a periodic reset.
It is, but it's a reset in which the opportunities are still there. So those surviving organisms have the opportunity to move into new niches, to develop new traits, to build on the diversity that they already have, and to expand in different ways and to go in different directions. And that's one of the reasons why you see this sudden explosion of diversity after an extinction.
All right, page 38, you finally get to one of the major points. Do aliens have sex? And so what is the case for and against sexual reproduction?
Well, we don't really know why sexual reproduction evolved on Earth. It's still a very controversial topic, but what we can say is that sexual reproduction seems to have accelerated the pace of evolution very, very rapidly. So when organisms reproduce asexually, like bacteria, they don't really tend to evolve very quickly. They rely on the odd mutation here and there. But sexual reproduction means shuffling your heritable characteristics with someone else. So your children really look very different from you. Bacteria's offspring look pretty much the same as the parent bacteria. But your children look really different because they're a mixture of you and your partner. So sexual reproduction seems to have accelerated the diversity, the accumulation of diversity in an ecosystem. Will that mean that alien planets will also have sexual reproduction? We can't say that. There will be some that don't. And those are likely to be fairly simple planets with fairly simple life, or less diverse anyway than on Earth. But on a planet where some kind of parallel of sexual reproduction has evolved, there we can expect to see a much greater diversity of life forms.
Greater diversity, greater speed of evolution too?
Yes, most likely. It seems likely that would be the case, because you're having new forms arising much more rapidly.
I want to take a pause here and consider differences in environments upon the Earth. I mean, how wide the range just on this planet of animals living in high temperature conditions, low temperature conditions, with oxygen, without oxygen. I mean, we have quite a bit of diversity just on this planet, don't we?
We do. It's a good question whether the diversity of environments we see on Earth is really representative of the diversity of environments we see on exoplanets. We tend to think that there's a much greater range of physical and environmental diversity across the galaxy than we could possibly see on Earth. We have planets that are extremely hot, extremely cold. There are a lot of planets, as we've discovered, that are tidally locked. So one side always faces their star, and the other side always faces away. So half the planet's in permanent day and half the planet's in permanent night. That's a very, very different environment from anything that we find on Earth. So although we've got a nice range of environments here on Earth, I think we can say that on other planets, the range is going to be very much greater.
All right, so much wider with the clouds of sulfuric acid of Venus or hot lava. So much greater range. But even so, I mean, we can't rule out life in those kinds of environments, can we?
I think we can't rule out life in those kinds of environments. That's right. And we don't know how life came to arise on Earth. So we know very little about the conditions that would be necessary for life to come into existence in the first place. But if it does come into existence, then we can sort of imagine different ways that it could cope with all of these different kinds of environments. Many of them that are very unfamiliar to us on Earth still seem to be at least possible habitats for life.
Let's go way, way back on this planet, because you take us there in the book, and the first creatures, you say, ate nothing but sunlight?
Well, all organisms need energy, that's for sure. And of course, the first energy that's available on a planet is the energy of the star that it's orbiting. It's not the only source of energy. There are other places, and some people have proposed that life might have arisen at volcanic vents underwater, where they got their energy from the heat coming up from the planet's core. But basically, until there is a certain density of life forms on a planet, you can't eat any of them. There aren't enough of them around. So you have to be getting your energy from some kind of inanimate source, whether it's the starlight or whether it's the heat of the planet or some other form of inanimate energy.
So, and what is the Garden of Ediacara?
Well, it's a controversial idea in the study of ancient life on Earth, but it does seem to be the case that many, many hundreds of millions of years ago, more than 500 million years ago, life on Earth had a very different character to what it does today and what we're used to, in that there didn't seem to be an awful lot of, there didn't seem to be a lot of shelled creatures. There didn't seem to be creatures that had a protective shell. There didn't seem to be creatures that had sharp teeth or seemed to move quickly through the water or burrow into the ground. And so one suggestion is that during this time, there wasn't a lot of predation, that animals weren't really eating each other very much, or at least the pressure of predation wasn't very high. So animals didn't need to evolve shells. They didn't need to burrow into the sand to hide away. And this could have been a period in Earth's history in which life was pretty relaxed, really.
So the need for creatures to consume other creatures for energy changed the whole game, in essence.
It certainly made things much higher stakes, yes.
So back to the earliest days of life on Earth and the first creatures eating nothing but sunlight. So once they did begin to consume each other, this certainly would be a pressure for evolution. It helps to move faster either than your prey or what sees you as prey. And so we began to get methods of locomotion.
Yeah, we know that these ancient animals did move. We know that early single-celled animals moved. You don't have to be an animal to single-celled creatures. You don't have to be an animal to move. So there was movement and there was predation and to some extent. But something happened. Something happened about half a billion years ago that changed everything. And all of a sudden, really within a very short period of time, animals evolved shells, they evolved teeth, they evolved eyes, and they evolved to run and to swim and to burrow very fast. So clearly some kind of tipping point was reached where the pressure of predation was sufficient to drive these kinds of innovations. And it seems likely that an event like that is probably necessary to drive the kind of diversity we have. You know, we would not have technological species like humans on this planet if we weren't, if our ancestors weren't running from predators and hiding in trees and trying to escape that kind of or solve all those kinds of problems.
You mentioned that the fluid environments of air and water, and there are fins and wings and structures like that. Legs come in handy, though, in particular for what kind of physical environment?
Well, we believe that life on Earth originated at a solid surface, so life didn't begin floating in the ocean. It was probably at the surface between rock and water. And so most of life that we see, certainly early life, evolved to live at the surface, at the junction between the rocks and the water. And when you're moving along a solid surface like a rock, it's very difficult to pull yourself along. There's a lot of friction. If you're just dragging yourself along the rock like a snail, it's quite hard work. And this is why snails excrete a slippery substance that they can slide along that reduces the friction. But a much better solution, and really a very simple one, is just to lift yourself off the surface. So you're only touching the surface at a few points, much less friction, but you can still exert a force and move along. And this is what legs are. Legs are a tremendously simple innovation, but they're one that provides a clear advantage for any organism living on a solid surface. And it seems almost inevitable that legs of some sort would evolve on any planet where organisms are living at a solid surface.
We have an email from Paul in Grants Pass who asks, I wonder what you view of which of these body types is more likely than the others, bipedal, hexapod, octopod?
Well, the interesting thing, of course, about those three examples is that they're all even, even number. And that's not a coincidence. So the reason that virtually all animals on Earth are symmetrical, they have a left side and a right side, is also to do with how these early life forms moved around. It's much, much more efficient to move if you have a left side and a right side. You can wriggle. You can move like an inchworm moving along. But to have a front and a back, you have to have a left and a right. So most life on Earth has evolved to be symmetrical, and that's why we have an even number of limbs. We happen to have four. And that's just a coincidence. The fish that was our ancestor from which we evolved hundreds of millions of years ago had four limbs, four fins, and that's why we have four limbs as well. It could have had six. It could have had eight. It really was just an evolutionary coincidence. And this is an important point because a lot of the details about how animals look really are evolutionary coincidences. The fact that it was four and not six, for instance. So when we find alien life, there's some things that we can say. For instance, they're likely to have an even number of limbs. Much harder to say exactly how many it will be, four, six, or eight.
Let's take another call here from Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Kirschenbaum, the author of The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy.
Hi, Dr. Kirschenbaum. It's a fascinating subject you brought up. I wanted to bring up what you think about certain physical chemical constraints. So So NASA has a saying that if they could find water, they could find life. And I guess that's a pretty fair assumption, but I want to see about some other assumptions and how you view the probabilities, you know, if they're high or low or medium. But a carbon-based life form, you know, because carbon is very flexible, you know, it's sort of like a Lego piece that you could make all these molecules out of. And how likely is it that most organisms will be carbon-based because there's not another atom that kind of provides that same flexibility? And then also along the same lines, calcium skeletons, you know, that calcium is a metal that's a lot easier to work with than any other metal, you know, for welding temperature or melting temperature. And then an oxygen metabolism-based, metabolic cycle.
Okay, so a bunch of things to think about there. Thank you for that, Jacob.
There are some very important points here. One is that to use energy needs to move around. You need to be able to move it around your body. You need to take it from the outside and bring it in. And that puts constraints on the chemistry that will work. Oxygen has a really important chemistry because you can use it to transfer energy from one place to another, from one compound to another. So this, what's called a redox chemistry, is generally thought to be a really useful thing for life. The thing about water is that although we don't know that water is necessary for life, we do know that liquid is necessary for life because chemical reactions don't really take place at any appreciable speed in a gas or a solid. So some form of liquid is necessary. And there are planets that have liquids other than water on them, which could possibly be candidates for life. But here's a really interesting thing to think about when you're thinking about these sort of sci-fi ideas of silicon-based life or carbon-based life and so on, which is that water and carbon are really, really, really common in the galaxy. They're not rare. Water is really common in our solar system. Comets are mostly made of water. And we can detect carbon chemicals throughout space. So these are not rare things. One of the reasons we think carbon chemistry is important is just it's so common, where silicon is very rare in a lot of the galaxy.
Let's take another call. Jeff in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, very interesting. I'm kind of fascinated by the animals we have on Earth here that live in colonies and that have kind of a collective way of life, where, like such as ants and bees and all, where the individual is less important than the colony itself. And I've seen in South America, I've seen army ants moving through, and it's really fascinating that they'll build their own little bridges and everything across the stream on their own bodies and whatnot. Just wondering how, what the possibility is that those kind of life forms could evolve into some kind of colony that could develop science or could develop the way humans have, or is that more likely with the life forms?
Yeah.
Place emphasis on individuals.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeff.
Yeah, that's a very popular idea and a very popular thought, and there are a lot of things that are possible, but I think it's pretty unlikely, actually. And the reason for that is that although I think that alien life on other planets may well evolve into these kinds of communal groups, I think that in itself is quite likely. But the individuals in these groups have very, very simple relationships with each other. Okay, an individual ant, yes, it will sacrifice itself for the colony, but that's partly because it sees itself in a very simple relationship with the colony. What drove human intelligence, we believe, what we see looking around, the kinds of animals that have a greater degree of problem solving, a greater degree of being able to invent tools and so on, these are animals with more complex social relationships. So if all I need to know is that I'm a drone, I'm a clone in my colony, I don't have much to think about. But if I need to think about, you know, if I want to improve my status in the colony, should I make an alliance with this guy who's friends with that one, who's enemies with that one? That's what seems to be driving the evolution of really complex intelligence. So it seems that a richer kind of set of relationships in a society might be necessary for technology and science.
Len and Ashlyn sent in an email with two questions. One, given the rapid pace of technological innovation by human beings on Earth, alien civilizations that have been around much longer should be engineering whole solar systems and even galaxies, something which we should be able to detect from the energy signature. If that were true, where are they? Two, does that apparent absence suggest technological civilizations destroy themselves soon after acquiring the means to do so? Again, that from Len and Ashlyn.
Yeah, it's a big question why we can't see any obvious signs of alien life in the sky. And there's two things to say about that. One is there could be an explanation such as you suggest, and I think that the explanation of technological civilizations destroying themselves seems a very reasonable explanation. Certainly if you look at what we're doing to our planet, it doesn't look very likely that we're going to survive. So it could be simply that other civilizations have gone extinct, or most of them. But the other thing to remember is we've really not been looking. We've looked at the tiniest portion of the sky and the tiniest portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. So, yes, if they were utterly swarming across the galaxy, we should see them. But if they are technological civilizations like ours, maybe more advanced, maybe a lot more advanced, essentially confined to their own solar system we just haven't looked hard enough yet.
And in terms of what aliens look like, I was really fascinated. The book is illustrated. I hadn't mentioned that thus far, but there's a visual example in the book of the velvet worm of today and hallucigenia of the past. Can you describe what we're talking about here?
Yeah, so this kind of goes back to this time in Earth's history when animals started to move fast and animals started to get a lot of the characteristics that we associate with them today. And one of the earliest creatures for which we have fossils is this incredible thing called a hallucigenia, because no one really believed when they looked at it whether such a creature could possibly exist. And it's a sort of worm on stilts, on multiple stilts and spiky stilts and also spines on its back. So it's a bit hard to see which way up it should go. But it's a good example of how once movement becomes really essential, once you're really chasing your prey or running away from predators, you need legs. You need those legs. You need them in pairs, one set down each side of your body, because that's how you move fast. And velvet worms, which are a modern analog of the ancient hallucigenia, they move very, very rapidly on these stubby little legs because it's just a very efficient way of moving.
There's a moment in the book, Eric, where you talk not just about the possibilities for life out there and what do the conditions that would dictate its structure would be, but you also get back to us at about how we will react as a species upon learning that we're not alone. Do you think we should be putting a bit more thought into this?
I think we should be putting more thought into it because it's something that's going to happen. I mean, I don't know that discovering simple life forms on a distant planet would affect the everyday lives of most people. But it does affect how we view ourselves and our place in the universe. And we have been constantly struggling over thousands of years to see what makes humans unique on Earth. And the more we study other animals, we see we're not that unique. And then the question is, if we're not alone in the universe, then we really aren't unique at all.
There is a whole lot to think about in the book and a whole lot we didn't get to. It is called The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. It's the work of Eric Kirschenbaum at Girton College at the University of Cambridge. Thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great fun.
All right, take care.